So nice to see all of you again in the morning. Now I'm sure you have your thinking caps on today. I'm sure that after our discussions yesterday, you are stimulated and want to move forward. So today we're going to go to the deeper end of the pool in honor of your prowess and abilities. Now, yesterday we discussed how basically all of you believe in God. And we discussed how far that gets you and how substantial that is. So I hope today that indeed you are wondering, what is God? What do the Vedas say about God? Without knowledge of God, as we discussed last night, we're just left to be sentimental. We can even become extremists. And if you cannot present Raja Vidya, the king of all knowledge, so-called intelligent or educated persons will say, oh, you're just like the terrorists. You believe something, and your belief may become so motivating and extreme that you'll do horrible things. So today we want to actually deal with what is knowledge of God. So please be patient and listen carefully. First, let us refer to Bhagavad Gita. I know that so many of you are considering Bhagavad Gita in a new light now that we have left the realm of religious sentiment and tradition handed down from grandmother to grandchild and so on and so forth. Let us hear what Lord Krishna says in chapter 8 of Bhagavad Gita, called Attaining the Supreme. Parastasmat tubhavanyo vyakto vyaktat sanatanaha yatsasarveshu bhuteshu nasyatsu na vanasyati. Bhagavan Sri Krishna speaks. Yet there is another unmanifest nature, which is eternal and is transcendental to this manifested and unmanifested matter. It is supreme, and it is never annihilated. When all in this world is annihilated, that part remains as it is. Now, today we're going to be discussing a subject I like to call deep cosmology. We're going to be discussing matter, the material energy, and what is beyond it. We're going to show you that unless you understand consciousness, you will not understand this world, what to speak of understanding the spiritual world. When we talk about consciousness, we are referring to that powerful indicator of the spiritual reality. No one can break down consciousness into anything material. In the scientific world, the majority of scientists do not say that they are sure consciousness is material. Most of them say they're not sure, or they don't talk about it. There is a minority that insists consciousness is matter, and any day we'll show that. Consciousness emerges from neural activity in the brain. This is just belief. There's no proof for this. Now, those of us who are familiar with the Vedic texts, we know that the difficulty scientists are having grappling with consciousness, understanding its origin, even understanding what it is, the difficulty is there because consciousness is indicating a non-material reality. As I was explaining at IIT, and you'll find in one booklet we have made based on a lecture I gave at IIT in Mumbai. There's not one scientific instrument in the world which can directly detect the presence of consciousness. Not one. All you can do is infer the existence of consciousness. All right. So, how are you going to understand what is God? Let us hear the Vedic version. But most people never get a chance to hear the authorized Vedic version. Therefore, there's so much hodgepodge, so many ideas spinning around in the head. This Swami said this, my grandmother said that, this politician said this. And no one has a clear understanding of the science of God. But if indeed we get genuine knowledge from Bhagavad Gita, we'll understand what is God, and we'll be able to have a clear understanding as well as clear experience, because we're practicing the techniques that give the clear experience. This is the life of the most advanced person, the most intelligent human being, the most successful person. Okay. Almost all of you, I'm sure, have heard of Louis Pasteur, the great scientist of the 19th century. Just think what he has said, which will give you insight into how this great challenge has still not been met. He's speaking to scientists. So many of you are studying technology, engineering. Maybe we have some research scientists here. In any case, think about this. What does Louis Pasteur say? You place matter before life, and you decide that matter has existed for all eternity. How do you know that the incessant progress of science will not compel scientists to consider that life has existed during eternity and not matter? You pass from matter to life because your intelligence of today cannot conceive of things otherwise. How do you know that in 10,000 years one will not consider it more likely that matter has emerged from life? This is one of the greatest scientists in history. Just see how prescient, how forward-thinking he is. Any of you ever heard that from quotation from Louis Pasteur? No, they don't teach you this in school. They just lock you in on matter as the cause of all causes. That's the religion of the West. Believe in matter, surrender to matter. Nothing else matters. And while you're believing in matter and surrendering to matter, get intoxicated as much as you can and have as much lust as you can. And then when you're dead, that's it. Is this life for you? Is this life for your children, your family? Is this what you want? But what can you say that is a better alternative? Well, I believe in God. Such a simple, rudimentary belief will not suffice. You need comprehensive scientific knowledge of God, and that is the greatest contribution of India to the world. Okay, we're going to talk about the universe. Please listen. How is the Vedic universe, that universe presented in the Vedic knowledge, different from current conceptions? Well, here is how. The Vedic universe swarms with life and intelligence. It's not that the earth is isolated from the rest of the cosmos. The Vedic texts give you knowledge of the interrelationships between various planets, various peoples. In this way, the residents of earth are no longer aliens, That means they're no longer strange creatures who have alienated themselves from universal life. Generally, you think of aliens as being people who may be from other planets. But in the human beings' concoction that Earth is the only planet with life, they have become aliens in that they have alienated themselves from universal life. The Vedic texts present universal life. They're not so silly as to think this planet, out of the countless planets in this cosmos, is the only one which has life. Nor are the Vedic texts so silly to say that there are countless other universes, but none of those universes got it right. The laws of chance did not produce situations for life in other universes. That's what some scientists are thinking. But only in this one universe were the laws of nature adjusted so perfectly by chance that life could exist. No, the Vedic texts don't accept this. In Bhagavad Gita, you probably never thought about it, but what does Krishna say? The living entity is Sarvagata. The living entity is everywhere present. Every place, every niche has some form of life, whether you can see it or not. Those of you who have knowledge of biology, biochemistry, you know that there are creatures now being well researched called extremophiles. How many of you know about extremophiles? Yes. They can live in extreme temperatures of hot or cold, unimaginable temperatures of hot and cold. They feel very comfortable there. They mate, they have families, even at such extreme, unimaginable temperatures. This lets you know, this gives you a powerful indicator that life can exist in any circumstance, whether you can see it or not. So, when you talk about the Vedic universe, you're talking about life and intelligence everywhere. And that intelligence is to different degrees. Now, the Vedic knowledge presents a universe that's bound up with spiritual energy. Therefore, the Vedic knowledge of the universe is far beyond what mundane science can present, because mundane science just recognizes matter. So, if you choose to participate in the special Vedic procedures for acquiring and experiencing spiritual knowledge, then you can gain entrance into the Vedic knowledge of God. It's not by belief. It is by the taking up of the special laboratory techniques. And actually, we're doing that here, in case you don't know. Whether you know it or not, you are participating in ancient Vedic processes for introducing you to the spiritual realm. We didn't bring you out here this weekend just to make you believers. We didn't bring you out here just to teach you some pujas of which everyone's forgotten the meaning. We brought you out here to get you involved, get you to participate in flawless techniques for experiencing the spiritual reality. We're introducing those to many of you. This is a monumental weekend for you. So if you just open yourself up a bit and walk into the laboratory and apply yourself to the techniques, you'll get the result. Mm-hmm. What do you think of the full-time research practitioners that we have here? Do you think they just adopted some beliefs? Maybe they came on previous weekends and they thought, oh, this is a nice belief and the pujas are very nice. Yeah, okay, I think I'll adopt this. Do you think that's what they've done? No, they are practicing these laboratory techniques. They're in the research laboratory and they're applying the techniques and getting the results. This is Raja Vidya, the king of all knowledge, Raja Guyam, the secret of all secrets, as Lord Krishna explains in the 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Okay, now, There are some barriers to entry in this Vedic science. Just like even in mundane material science or knowledge, there are barriers to entry. How many of you in your studies here in Melbourne just walked to RMIT, walked into the office, walked into Melbourne University or Monash and said, okay, here I am, I want to study. How many of you did that? No, there were entrance barriers. You had to show your qualifications. So similarly, to understand Vedic knowledge, there are entrance barriers. Sometimes people become upset at that. They say, oh, that there are entrance barriers to understanding Krishna means it's not real knowledge, it's not real science. Real science is universal. Anyone can access it. Does that sound like the science you know? Anyone can access it? You all are studying things that are so specialized, the general public, unless educated in that specific knowledge that you're studying, they have no idea what's going on, right? You ever try to communicate what you're studying to your parents? So why is it that just because bhakti yoga, Krishna consciousness, requires specialized entrance, that it's something different? It's the same in terms of its having entrance requirements. It is different in terms of its dealing with not only matter, but dealing with spirit also. For example, people accept, generally, Big Bang Theory. But you're faced with insurmountable physical limitations when you consider the Big Bang Theory. You immediately get into deep water, far over your head. How will you ever know why the Big Bang happened? What came before? With your limited intelligence and senses, you'll never know. Why? Because the origin of the universe is too far away from you in time and space. So therefore, it's very convenient to posit the Big Bang and to infer what we've heard, the sound remnants. Or that's okay. But what? Even if you accept that it happened, what was there before? And why did it happen? Material science can never teach you that. So here, once again, you see, there are barriers that you can't cross. You have to accept inconceivable things. So it's not just that when you approach Krishna, you have to accept inconceivable things. Even in your ordinary, mundane, scientific knowledge, you have to have inconceivable presuppositions. How will you ever understand life on distant planets and stars? How can you do that? What's the nearest star? Who knows the name of the nearest star? All right. How long would it take a spacecraft to get there? If you have a spacecraft 10 times more powerful than what we have now, it would have to go 1 million miles an hour to get to Alpha Centauri in 3,000 years. These are the barriers to your knowledge. How do the Vedas cross this huge gulf? How do they navigate across such an impossible distance of time and space? It's done by sound. Sound vibration coming from outside the universe into this universe. That is the Vedic sound, and that Vedic sound presents knowledge which you can apply in your life, and then your senses become extended because of your hearing the Vedic sound. You get knowledge from what is far beyond your ordinary sense perception. Just like there's although I have been to India at least 50 times, there are places I haven't been to. I haven't been to Trivandrum. Anyone from Trivandrum? Yes. I was just dealing with matters about Trivandrum recently. Why? Even though I've never been there, one of my godbrothers told me, only in Trivandrum can you get a certain type of cloth called kavi, which is naturally saffron, and it's very light, good for the summer. I've looked all over India. I can't find it, but only in Trivandrum. Now, I've never been there, but I'm hearing. I'm getting the knowledge through the ear. And then, now we're making arrangements, how to get this cloth, if it's still there at the merchant. Did you know about this in Trivandrum? You know the cloth called kavi? Yes. Oh, maybe you can help me get some. Supposedly nowhere else in India. So, how do I know about this? By hearing. But will I just say, I believe in Trivandrum there is a cloth called kavi? No. I hear the information and then I apply myself. I apply my senses to verify that reality. Similarly, although the Vedic sound vibration comes from outside of time and space, you can apply your senses to it according to its instructions, and you'll get experience. So we're not true believers. We are practitioners. Please understand that. Okay. How do we know about other dimensions in space and time besides ours? Do other universes exist? It's very fashionable today to speak of other universes. Cosmologists now say that the universe is something that happens now and then. There are parallel universes. We talked yesterday about the multiverse theory, that there are billions of universes and none of them got it right for life. Only this universe we're in got the conditions right for life. This is all speculation. But from the Vedic viewpoint, yes, there are unlimited universes, but each one of them is perfect for life. In the Vedic cosmology, universes are cheap and plentiful, like grains of sand at the beach. So quickly, let's go over a list of Vedic cosmological themes. Number one, intelligent life abounds on other planets. Many planets have civilizations far more advanced than anything Earth has seen. The Sun is indeed the center of the universe, but there are so many planets in this universe that you, with your human eyes or human instruments, can't detect. The Vedic texts present to you that interplanetary communication and traveling is as routine as calling from a street coin phone or cycling to a neighborhood convenience shop. No big deal. And, especially in Srimad Bhagavatam, you'll read how previous civilizations on Earth were in constant contact with other planets. It's interesting. People have always wondered, okay, the Vedic texts like Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, they're talking about a glorious Vedic culture, civilization in India, far more advanced than anything we see now. Where are the traces? Do you ever wonder that? Well, first of all, the main trace is in the Shastra, in the Vedic texts it's described. But people today, they want to see something in, you know, bricks, some mud, something that shows there was such a civilization. Just recently, many scientists are putting forth that they have uncovered that 5,000 years ago, a huge tsunami hit India, 10 times bigger than anything we know about in recent days. This is now a mainstream scientific theory. A huge tsunami hit India about 5,000 years ago and just completely changed the face of India. So there are so many reasons why you don't get any kind of material remnants of Vedic culture. But the main thing is you have the remnant in sound vibration. And if you take advantage of that sound, you'll get experience. Okay, what else? The Vedic texts teach us that the first living entities in the universe are the most intelligent, and their lifespans and abodes far exceed what we can understand. Even in your coming from India to Australia, you were in for so many surprises if you had never been here before. It took you a while to adjust. Maybe some of you are still adjusting. Yes, isn't it so? When you first came here, you were shocked by the behavior of the people. So many things were new and alien to you. This universe is endlessly variegated, so many different varieties of conditions. Why do you limit the variegatedness just to Earth and say there are no living entities anywhere else? Lord Krishna says clearly in Bhagavad Gita, life is everywhere. Indeed, what does Lord Krishna say in the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita? Imam vavastrate yogam proktavanaham avyam. I have spoken knowledge of the Gita millions of years ago to the chief living entity, to the president of the sun planet. Now, what are you going to say about that? Huh? What do you say? Do you feel uncomfortable with that? Oh, it sounds mythological, Swamiji. What do you say? Krishna says, I spoke knowledge of the Gita millions of years ago to the chief entity of the sun planet. Say something. What about?
Sprit lives everywhere.
Huh?
Sprit lives everywhere.
Spirit
lives everywhere. So.
How do you know?
According to you, said it may live in fire, earth, water, everywhere. So it can.
According to me. Where do I get this from?
From Gita.
Yes, but is that good enough for you? Huh?
The soul can live in water as well as in fire. So it's present in everywhere.
Yes, yes, yes. That is the Vedic version. And if you adopt the Krishna conscious techniques, you can verify that knowledge. But is that good enough for you? What do you say?
There can be life on sun as well.
Krishna says, I spoke this Gita to the chief entity, the president of the sun planet. What are you going to say?
There must be some form of life there then.
No. Yeah. Let's hear from others. Do you feel intimidated? Do you feel uncomfortable by that statement?
Yeah, we don't have any other option. We'll just accept it as a belief.
Just accept it as a belief. Anyone else?
It's hard to reject as well. And it's hard to accept, but even hard to reject.
Anyone else? These are good points.
In fact, scientists even wrote that even the age of the Earth is a few millions of years or whatever.
Say that?
Even science has proved the age of Earth or planets are a few millions and dinosaurs have lived thousands of years before.
I couldn't hear.
The science believes that the Earth's been there millions of years.
And so?
So, similar fashion, maybe they're yet to find these things or something like that, that's it. But there's no way that they can deny this fact, this is true.
Anyone else? In the back? Now, someone was saying, we should believe it. But why not hear what Krishna says and then take up Krishna's techniques for verifying what he says? That would be much better. And that's what we're trying to inspire you all to do. We are trying to inspire you all to be the vanguard of real civilization. You are the chosen ones, in case you haven't realized it. You have a much greater mission in life than, you know, to do like everyone else, booze it up on the weekends and, you know, watch passionate movies and simply make a lot of money and watch your children turn into monsters. You have better things to do. Okay, let's go on. What I've just told you about Vedic cosmology certainly is startling, but actually we've just touched on the beginning, because Vedic knowledge deals with consciousness. Therefore, simply hearing about other planets in the material universe is not so exciting when you can hear about life outside the realm of matter. That is the specialty of Srimad Bhagavatam. And Bhagavad Gita introduces that realm in the verse we read today, Parastasmatubhavanyo. Krishna is saying, there's something else besides this universe of matter, which is created and annihilated, appears and disappears. There's something else outside of it all. There's a realm in which there's no creation and annihilation. Krishna is letting you know what is the real goal of scientific research. But you have to adopt bhakti yoga techniques to experience that non-material realm. Actually, the final stop of your journey in life, if it's successful, is the realm of pure spiritual consciousness, where no matter exists. That's what Krishna's referring to in Bhagavad Gita. A realm of pure spiritual consciousness. Now, the Vedic knowledge explains that only when you attain the full transcendental or spiritual vision can you then understand why there are universes of matter and how they originated. You've got to get to the ultimate source of everything. And this getting to the ultimate source is what present science has the most difficulty with. They don't even want to talk about it. What's the source of everything? They call it the big questions. Let's not deal with that, they say. Let's just, you know, improve the technology. But in terms of the most important questions, they don't want to deal with. But Vedic science, Krishna conscious knowledge, deals with the biggest questions, the most important issues. We're not afraid of those questions. We relish them. We thrive on them. And you can also do the same. Okay. Now, you all know how we live in a realm where matter and consciousness coexist. So, how is this possible? How is there such a thing as matter and consciousness? You can't reduce consciousness to matter. So, how are the two coexisting? How does Western knowledge deal with this? They just say, everything is matter. Begin with matter and end with matter. There's no way you can explain consciousness as matter, though. Therefore, consciousness is their big problem. Their own consciousness is a problem also. Understanding consciousness, it's a big problem. Because do you understand what Western knowledge means? It means there's nothing but matter, inert matter, that's all. But this paradigm is starting to break down. Anytime they make a new discovery, it's always fitted into the realm of physical science, physical knowledge. Just like all your life you've seen darkness. And then when you finally encounter some light, what will you think? You'll think the darkness produced the light because all you're experiencing, all your life is darkness. All of a sudden there's some light. Oh, the darkness must have made it. Similarly, scientists today, whenever they encounter any new phenomenon, any new situation, it's always physical, it's always matter. They can't understand anything else. So try to understand the world view that they're trying to get you to buy into. They're trying to get you to believe, to be a true believer in matter. When you completely understand materialism, all space, all time, all matter, all energy, then you'll understand everything in the universe. This is a presumption, but it is the grand paradigm of the world. The world view that underlies everything else. There's nothing except matter, and there'll never be anything except matter. And when you understand matter, you understand everything. Obviously, this is very, this belief is very presumptuous, arrogant, and it leads to such a despair and emptiness in people. And what do you do in a culture, in a civilization where there's so much emptiness and despair? What happens next? Who knows?
Suffering?
Well, definitely suffering. But how? How do you cope with a society that's just immersed in emptiness and despair? You can't do it unless there's heaps of intoxication. That's why you notice here in Australia, life can't go on without it. And they want you to be like that too. Work, make money, be full of emptiness and despair, but solve that problem with intoxication. What do you think? After the intoxication doesn't work, what comes next? That's part of intoxication.
No.
Suicide. Suicide, right. Is this what you want? Is this the kind of lifestyle, the kind of future you want to offer to your future children, your family? But what can you say that's different? All right, let's move on. We don't accept that everything comes from matter. We, based on the Vedic texts and the Vedic scientific practices, we assert that consciousness is a fundamental feature of reality, not a byproduct. Consciousness doesn't come from matter. Consciousness always exists. But because people know nothing about consciousness, they know nothing about the supreme consciousness. Therefore, matter appears to be the all in all. How many of you in your studies are given a chance to study spiritual consciousness? Anyone? How many of you even study what consciousness is? Anyone? So this is the result of the Western grand paradigm. Matter is the all in all. Everything else is a folk tale, mythology. But this belief that matter is everything is mythology in of itself. But that you're never told. So you have nothing to be ashamed about in your Krishna conscious progress. Of course, there is much pride and arrogance because Western science is very successful in terms of technological gadgets. In a narrow, very narrow spectrum, a very narrow realm, Western science is very successful. DVD players, iPods. So because of that success in a very narrow and questionable realm of human achievement, people then speculate, because I have an iPod, because I have a DVD player, those who made it, they can also understand the universe. Srila Prabhupada, the founder of our Krishna Conscious Society in the Western world, he would always say, all right, you have made some gadget. You have made something like a DVD player, iPod. Fine, but don't say you solved the problems of life and don't say you understand the universe. Go on making your gadgets. Go on making your GPS systems, whatever. Go ahead, but just don't think you've done anything important. That's all. What do you think? Challenging, isn't it? All right. Now, we all are aware of consciousness, but nothing in the science you learn gives you understanding why you should be conscious. How many of you have enrolled in courses at the university and the professor says, today we shall discuss why you have consciousness? No. We'll deal with that. In this way, you can see you're missing the most important part of education. But Krishna deals with this straight on. The Vedic texts, especially Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, deal with this issue straight on. They don't duck it. This is how you'll become very powerful. You'll become totally familiar with issues that everyone else is ducking. So this is India's real contribution to the world. Not just simply, you know, having call centers. And sending, you know, software engineers all around the world to take everyone else's jobs. All right. When you look at the ancient Vedic standpoint, that timeless knowledge that Lord Krishna speaks, you find a reverse of the modern position. The modern position is everything comes from matter. The Vedic position is that everything comes from consciousness, or more particularly, everything comes from spirit. Consciousness is the energy of the non-material soul. That is the primary fact of existence. The conscious entity. Matter is secondary. Now, the Western view, what is that? Matter is the main thing, and that matter is everything. But from the Vedic viewpoint, matter is secondary. It's something that comes after the fact. Let us hear more about this. We're going to turn to the Upanishads. And the Upanishads are very famous for giving preliminary hints for enlightenment. Not so much the ultimate, but they give preliminary hints for enlightenment. The Upanishads do point out the ultimate, but they don't give so much information about it. But they train your thinking in order that you can properly approach the ultimate reality without presuppositions and preconceptions. So what's the first strong hint we want to meditate on today? Anor Aniyan Mahato Mahiyan. The Supreme Absolute Truth is present as the tiny living entity as well as the immense universe. What does this mean? That means, first, try to understand yourself. You, the tiny living entity. Analyze what are the components of your existence. Analyze what's the active principle of your life. Once you understand yourself as a microcosm, a tiny, minute unit, then with that understanding, you'll be able to grasp or understand the immense whole, the universe, the macrocosm. Anor Aniyan Mahato Mahiyan. Once you understand the basic active principle of your life, the basic components of your life, then you can understand the basic components of the universe. First, understand the small, and then you can understand the big. Or you can go the other way too. If you truly understand the big, you'll understand the small. Very interesting. Mm. Now, actually, I don't think anyone here is studying astrophysics. Anyone? No, no. No money in that. Astrophysicists simply hope to get fame, but there's no money. You know, they have to desperately wait for grants. But you have positioned yourselves differently, yes. You want immediate cash returns, right? Accounting, engineering, yes. The more practical fields. Okay, so even modern astrophysicists tell us that we cannot understand the universe unless we understand the subatomic realm. We can't understand the macrocosm unless we understand the microcosm. But when they say this, they never refer to consciousness. They leave consciousness completely out of the picture, whether they're talking about the macrocosm or the microcosm. Whether they're talking about the subatomic level or they're talking about the whole universe, they can't account for consciousness. They can't analyze it. They can't say where it comes from, why it's here. This is the huge limitation in Western knowledge. Now, let's talk about consciousness. Before we get to the first level of understanding God, which is called Brahman realization. Many of you have heard the term Brahman before? Raise your hands. Yes. Okay. So that is just a preliminary level, but we'll deal with that very soon. Because we want you all to become equipped with how to understand and teach the science of God. In Srimad Bhagavatam, it is stated, Vadanti tattvavidas tattvam yaj gyanavadvayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavan iti shabdite. The Supreme Absolute Truth can be understood from three angles of vision. Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Brahman, the all-pervading reality. Paramatma, the super soul in every heart of every creature and in every atom. And then Bhagavan. We spoke briefly about Bhagavan yesterday. The supreme opulent person. We're going to present to you these three levels of understanding the Supreme Absolute Truth. And in this way you'll be able to say, what is God? Alright. Now, as you know, consciousness is the only thing you directly experience. You're not experiencing this room directly. You're not experiencing the people in this room directly. You're experiencing them through your consciousness, your awareness. That's why if your awareness changes, what you experience in this room will change. So, first accept the point that you're not experiencing anything except as it comes through your consciousness. So if you change your consciousness, your whole world changes. This is why we recommend the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. The sound vibration of the Hare Krishna mantra purifies your consciousness. And you see everything differently. Some of you, I know, have begun seriously chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. Please raise your hands. Who's done that? Yes, very good. You notice your whole worldview is changing. What is the first major change you notice because you're chanting Hare Krishna? This is stated by Lord Chaitanya. Chaito darpanam arjanam. Baba maha davagni nirvapanam. The first symptom you'll notice once you enter into the Maha Mantra laboratory is that you don't think you're the body anymore. The dirt in your consciousness of identifying with matter is cleansed away. And therefore there's a complete decrease in material anxiety, material hankering, material longings, because you are getting direct experience by chanting Hare Krishna that you're not the body, you're not the mind. That's the first step. So, if you can purify your consciousness, your whole world will change. You're getting at the root of everything. Where are people being taught this information? If I can just purify my consciousness, my whole perceptions change, my awareness changes. That means I deal with people differently, I deal with the world differently. This is the effect of chanting Hare Krishna, the preliminary effect of chanting Hare Krishna. The ultimate effect of chanting Hare Krishna is that your dormant love for Krishna is provoked, revived. But that's down the road a bit. First, you'll feel peace. You'll feel satisfaction because you're not an illusion anymore. You don't think you're the body and mind. That's the first phase. See? No belief, all practical experience. Of course, in order to get to this point of having some experience, you need some preliminary notion that this could be worthwhile, this endeavor I'm making, this experiment I'm making. It could be worthwhile. But you're not left with just those notions. You are given factual experience of the spiritual reality once you enter into the laboratory. Just like so many of you, you came to Australia, you had some preliminary notions. It'll be a good thing. It'll be good for my future. It'll be good for my family in India. But then you actually had to come and experience. So similarly, you just need some preliminary good thoughts about taking up Krishna consciousness. And then you enter the laboratory and apply yourself. Then you get the results. Sounds very clear, doesn't it? But you know, some people object. This is too clear. Now, I know none of you would ever say that. But when I speak to Australians, sometimes they actually object like this. What you're saying is just too clear. It can't be right. It's just too clear. You make it sound so easy. All we have to do is chant Hare Krishna and our vision of reality changes. Oh, I don't believe that. It can't be that simple. Then I asked him, well, do you have an alternative method? No, but anyway. I think you all are capable of gathering your energies of concentration and focusing on what should be done in life. Now, you can cultivate the chanting of Hare Krishna even while you're working or studying. We have persons here working and studying who are chanting Hare Krishna. Raise your hands. Yes. Now, what's wrong? Why is it they can do that? You're a married man, yes? You have a child? He'll be a father soon. How is it you're chanting Hare Krishna? Is your wife here, or she's not able to come because of her? Right. So she's expecting. Nityananda Priya, he has a how old is your son?
He'll be three.
Mm-hmm. Your wife is here? Yes. How is it? Wait, you're married and you have a child? You're chanting Hare Krishna? We thought chanting Hare Krishna is only done by the brahmacharis. By the full sadhus. The rest of us, we should just believe, be believers, and just make a lot of money. So look, here you see, it's happening all around you. While you're wondering what to do in life, others are pushing ahead. They're working, they're studying. Yes. Angus, you're studying?
Yeah.
What are you studying?
I do my PhD.
PhD in what?
Wireless communication.
And you're chanting Hare Krishna also? How is it possible? Don't you lose ambition? Don't you lose career determination? Anyone else? Any Matajis who are chanting Hare Krishna? Yes. What are you studying? You finished. You're doing your internship now? Okay. And you're chanting Hare Krishna? How do you have time to do that? To be an intern at a hospital? So busy. And yet you're chanting. You see, it's happening. What do you think? They look like freaks? What you are seeing is the possibility for yourself. Just like they are doing, you can also do. All right. We spoke about how consciousness is the only thing we directly experience. Everything that we come in contact with comes to us through consciousness. Therefore, if you chant Hare Krishna, everything changes because you only know everything through your consciousness. That's why when your consciousness is low, everything will be low. So the whole process of bhakti yoga is to make accessible to you the realms of higher consciousness. And the highest realm of consciousness is Krishna consciousness. This is called Bhagavan realization. We'll deal with that gradually. I'm not going to overload you too much this morning. Don't worry. I know you're very bright and intelligent, but still, I have to be careful. I'll be able to sense when you're at your limit. Don't mind me. I can go on like this all day, but I have to think of you and your capacities. Because this kind of information requires sharpness. It requires a clear mind. And in case you haven't noticed, everything in society today is to help you have a mind that is totally disturbed and full of anxiety and stress. There's nothing in society today to help you to have a clear, focused mind. Therefore, you'll never be able to understand these points of Vedic knowledge if you remain immersed in materialistic lifestyle. You'll never be able to understand. All right. Now, as long as you leave consciousness out of your science, you'll never understand the parts, you'll never understand the whole. Therefore, when you approach Vedic knowledge, you understand what I see in the living entity, I will see in the whole universe. I see consciousness in the living entity, therefore I will expect to find consciousness in the whole universe. That is the meaning of Anur Anyan Mahato Mahiyan. Now, this is preliminary Vedic knowledge. This preliminary knowledge is trying to push you just a little bit. Get you to think. Try to understand. You find consciousness in the tiny living entity. Therefore, you should also look for consciousness on the grand cosmic scale. And you can go even further. You can find consciousness beyond the cosmos. But that's another thing. We won't go there right now. Don't want to overload you. Okay. Now, the Vedic knowledge presents your body as a small universe. And just like the bodies of living entities are instruments of consciousness, similarly, the universe is also the instrument of consciousness. That means the reality of the spirit soul is essential not only for our existence on the microcosmic scale as tiny living entities, but also the reality of the spirit soul is necessary for universal functions on the macrocosmic scale. You see how this basic information from the Upanishads has such power to change your thinking completely. Now, I think we'll make one last point this morning before, and in our next session, we'll go into the three phases of understanding what is God, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. We want to give you something solid that you can really take with you. I know this presentation is giving you a bit of a workout, but I think you can hang with it. Okay. We're going to, finally, this morning, deal with the subject matter of nature conforming to conscious direction. Now, first, consider your body. Your body is an amazing physiological machine. And the universe is an amazing cosmological machine. The difference, of course, is one machine is tiny, the other is immense. So, if you can understand how the miracle of consciousness directs your tiny living system, known as your body, then why is it fantasy? Tell me, why is it fantasy to think that the same miracle of consciousness can activate and direct planets, functions of nature, and the entire universe? Think about it. Your body is directed by consciousness. But this body is very tiny. Still, you can consider your body to be like a universe, so tiny. It's directed by consciousness. So, then why, when you think of the universe, is it fantasy to say that consciousness activates the whole universe, just like it activates your individual body? Consciousness directs planets and functions of nature, just like consciousness directs the functions of your little body. Why is that fantasy? So, now you are getting insight by the mercy of the Upanishads. The Upanishads are bringing you nearer so that you can understand Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. This is the Vedic system. Not to overload you all at once, but to bring you closer and closer. So that when you finally hear about Krishna, your mind will be free from dangerous misconceptions and stereotypes and folk tales. All right. Last point for this morning. This is a scientific point, which I'm sure you will all easily grasp because you're all steeped in applied scientific knowledge. We're going to talk about consciousness as making things happen, causing things, causative. Think about that for a few moments. Whether you're talking about the micro or the macro, your individual body or the whole universe, consciousness is doing things, it's making things happen. Why did you come here this weekend? What's the explanation? Was it a random... Was it the result of a random bumping of molecules? Or random quantum fluctuations? Why are you here? Who can tell me? Why are you here? Someone different, please. Why are you here? Why did you come here? Yes.
To know about God.
But how did that happen? Simply the neurons in your brain just in a random chance came up with this movement of yours here? Because there's no such thing as a free will. Be scientific now. There's no such thing as free will. So what you are saying then is your consciousness has caused something to happen in the realm of matter. That's what you're saying. You understand? Now, if you realize that consciousness is non-material, then basically what you're saying is a non-material cause has made something happen in the realm of matter, in the material world. Is that so far-fetched? You could consider that at least, yes? How many of you think you came here just because of a random interaction between molecules or a random quantum fluctuation? Huh? Any? Yes, because you are actually basically religious persons. But we want to change you from being believers into practitioners. Is that all right? When you leave here this weekend, we want that you throw aside all your traditional notions and customs, pujas. Leave it all behind. Do us a favor. And accept the knowledge that Lord Krishna is giving. Accept the laboratory techniques that Lord Krishna is giving. So we want to wipe the slate clean. Just erase the whiteboard of all these misconceptions. And we want you to go away this weekend having in your hands the tools to be a practitioner, an experiencer of the spiritual reality. We don't want you to leave here this weekend being a believer. Okay? This is exciting. All right, last point for this morning. And then you're entitled to your breakfast. If you look at Western science, you'll even find some very forward-thinking scientists who point out that consciousness causes things. There's a Nobel Prize winner named Roger Sperry. He has published a paper in which he describes that if you look at the world of everyday affairs, you'll see two kinds of causation. One he calls upward causation, which is the usual thing you've been taught in school. The other he calls downward causation. Now, what is upward causation? I'll read it to you to make it quick. Upward causation, what you're usually taught in school, university, is that the billiard balls of cosmic stuff, whether particles, waves, atoms, or molecules, bump into each other and interact. And then all these microcosmic reactions hidden to non-scientists all add up to something happening on the visible level that everyone can see. Isn't that what you've been taught in school? Yes? Mm-hmm. Just like, look at a car. What happens inside a car? Molecular interaction causes combustion. The gas molecules expand, forcing the piston to move, right? You have any mechanical engineers here? Okay. You niching on the brief, you're a mechanical engineer? I thought you were IT.
Yeah, Swiss.
Oh, you're Swiss. Okay. Okay. So the gas molecules expand, forcing the piston to move, the crankshaft revolves, and then ultimately the car backs out of the driveway and travels to the nearest motorway, right? Mm-hmm. This is the motive analysis champion in the West. It's quite familiar to all of you. The fundamental belief that physical interaction of minute things causes all larger realities. Right? But this Nobel Prize winning scientist, he's way ahead, and he's actually right at the doorstep of Vedic knowledge. He presents something else called the second concept of causality, downward causation instead of upward. Upward means little microcosmic interactions cause big things to happen in the visible world. But he goes another way, downward causation. And this is the way championed by the Vedic knowledge. So, we talked about the car backing out of the driveway, going to the nearest motorway. You could describe that whole experience based on gas molecules expanding, forcing the piston to move. You heard it all. But here's another way, downward causation. My car's engine turns on and the vehicle moves out onto the street. Why? Because you decided you wanted to go somewhere. You decide, I want to visit my relatives, I want to go to the shopping center. Think about it. What does this mean? This means your consciousness caused a complex chain of reactions and interactions in this world on both the micro and macro scale. It's a completely different way of looking at things, but it's much more logical. Your consciousness is causing things to happen on all levels of the universe. But consciousness is not material. So therefore, this Nobel laureate has concluded that consciousness is a causal reality. It makes things happen. And he also adds, in a very revolutionary way, he says that consciousness is qualitatively different from matter. This is a Nobel Prize winner. Now, of course, most scientists will not say such things. But this shows you, some of the most brilliant scientists are coming so close to the Vedic version. And what are we doing? Oh, I'm a little ashamed of Vedic knowledge. Oof, I don't know how much it will add to my career. Krishna says he spoke to the chief living entity of the sun planet. I don't know. We are feeling embarrassed. And here are these topmost scientists, a few of them, are coming so close to the halls of Vedic knowledge. Just think of the opportunity you have to do the greatest good for the world by championing this Vedic knowledge, by teaching what Lord Krishna has taught. Okay. Naturally, if you're a dyed-in-the-wool materialist, if you're a very addicted materialist, you can't accept the Vedic principles, and you can't accept even what this Nobel laureate has said. It all seems odd. So what you're seeing now happening in the world is a coming clash between two worldviews. It's going to happen not on a battlefield, but it's going to happen in the chambers of knowledge, the halls of academics. Just like now in the Middle East, you have a collision between two worldviews. You have the fundamentalists fighting the global marketers. That's basically what's going on. And who gets the oil? Will the fundamentalists get the oil? Or will the global marketers get the oil? Now, we're dealing with a much more important clash, which is for the betterment of the world. And it's happening in a peaceful way. This is a clash that doesn't occur on a battlefield, but it occurs at the universities and the colleges. We are seeing the development of a peaceful army of the most elevated persons, persons who are radiating the best qualities. And they are showing that, indeed, the Vedic knowledge has the answers we're looking for. It is not folklore. It's not mythology. It is practical. It gives you the techniques for verifying. We are seeing the rise of this greatest army of spiritually intelligent persons. Most of them have families. Most of them have jobs. But as their main priority in life, they're fixed on the supreme consciousness, the all-attractive Krishna, and they can explain to everyone. Just like I've explained today, you'll be able to do that also. And then you'll see a change in the world. So, we're going to see if you have some questions now. And later today, we're going to deal with the three phases of God realization, or the three ways that you can see the Supreme. And one way is more complete than the other. When you get to Bhagavan realization, the pinnacle, that is the most complete understanding of what is God. But we'll also start with Brahman. We'll go to Paramatma. And in this way, you, maybe for the first time, for many of you, maybe for the first time, you're getting authorized, an authorized Vedic presentation of what is God. All right. Any questions? That wasn't too much, by the way?
Okay.
I didn't use words that were hard to understand. Because when I, by the way, the first time I gave a lecture at IIT in Mumbai, I was speaking about these kind of things, but in language, later I was told it's too complicated. Since then, about 6 years ago, I've been careful to present these subject matters in English that's not too, you know, not too complicated. To get the point across in a way that's more easily understood. So I just want to make sure I you know, because for me, you know, English is my first language, so it's, you know. But you all, you know, you're knowing so many languages. Hindi and what else? Tamil. Anything else? Huh?
Punjabi.
Anything else? Gujarati, of course. Any Bengalis? All right, so therefore, you know, I had to adjust my language, so I hope that I was successful in doing that. The main thing are the points, the essential points. Okay, your question?
Yeah. Actually, I was just wondering, like, what's the difference with the conscious level and the subconscious level?
You have to start again. Someone.
I was just wondering about the conscious and the and the subconscious level. I think subconscious has also some play a part in the role. So
subconscious plays a part in what?
Like, it has got some role in, like, what we believe and what we have felt, sort of thing.
Yes, and so?
Can you please throw some light on subconscious part as well?
Subconsciousness simply means consciousness that you're not aware of. That's all. I know Western psychology makes a big deal out of subconsciousness. It simply means the part of your awareness, the part of your consciousness that you don't see in an everyday way. That's all. It's just consciousness. That's all. It just means consciousness you're not aware of.
And what is unconsciousness?
Unconsciousness. You can't ever lose your consciousness. Consciousness is the energy of the soul. But you can be deep asleep at night in a state in which you're not even dreaming. Now, the Vedic texts are more precise. They don't say you're unconscious. In Western talk, if like someone takes a pipe and hits you on the head, you collapse on the ground, they say you're unconscious. So, as if suddenly your consciousness completely went away. And then when you wake up, then your consciousness comes back. You become conscious. They say he came to consciousness again. But the Vedic talk isn't like that. When you are collapsed on the ground because someone hit you on the head with a pipe, it doesn't mean you're unconscious. It just means you're in a state of consciousness in which you've lost awareness. At night, you can either dream, or you can go into a deeper state of sleep in which you don't even dream. So the Vedic texts analyze that experience of consciousness as wakefulness, dreaming, and deep sleep, not unconsciousness. So yes, Western language is not very intelligent for spiritual subject matters, especially English. English is the language for business. It's very precise for business dealings. You notice? French is the language for passionate romance. It used to be that German was the main language for science and engineering. That's changing. But and English is especially for business, commerce. And Sanskrit is the language of spiritual knowledge. Very precise. Therefore, in Sanskrit, you have another generic name for Krishna, Turiya. Krishna exists in the fourth dimension, beyond wakefulness, dreaming, and deep sleep. So that kind of nomenclature, or that kind of, those kind of terminologies, you'll find only in the Sanskrit language. Just like in Sanskrit, matter is referred to as dvitiya, the second, as opposed to consciousness, which is the first. So just by the language, it makes things clear. Just like the English language makes business dealings very clear. Anything else?
How should we understand the thing like when Krishna said to Arjuna that this is the knowledge I gave to son, and I said like we have to believe because we don't have any option. I mean, how should we understand?
You still feel you have no other option than to believe? Why? Why don't you take up Krishna's techniques so you can verify what he's saying?
Yeah, what should we do on it in that case?
Well, that's our whole system here. Our whole system of bhakti yoga we're giving you, Krishna's giving you, is for verifying what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita.
Is it by bhakti yoga only, like not by dharma yoga?
For understanding what? To understand that there is a chief living entity of the sun planet, you don't need bhakti yoga. You can do other methods, but because it's just ordinary truth, ordinary understanding of this world, of this universe. It's not considered spiritual. The important thing is, Krishna is saying, I spoke Bhagavad Gita to the chief living entity of the sun. So you should be focusing on Bhagavad Gita, not trying to see the sun god. You understand? Now, the reason why in India people have this idea that there are so many gods, you worship whatever god you like, is because they have confused approaching the supreme being, the supreme consciousness, Krishna, with approaching lesser entities like Vivaswan on the sun planet. Just like you can confuse mayors of cities with the prime minister. So, unfortunately, due to lack of proper training, so many people in India think, oh, there are many gods, choose one, whatever you like.
Is that according to our requirement? Like for a local street work, we need to go to mayor and for,
In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna advocates one-stop shopping. Come to the one warehouse that has everything. Don't waste your time. And in fact, what does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? He says, those who approach the devas, the demigods, don't understand that actually I'm giving everything. What are you studying in school?
I'm doing a PhD in mechanical
engineering. Mm. Now, why do you go into school for mechanical engineering?
Making a device which helps people.
No, but there's mechanics everywhere. There's so many mechanical devices everywhere, all around. Why don't you just tune into them and get knowledge?
One more device.
Huh?
No,
but why are you... You missed the point. Why are you doing your PhD?
You should make a device.
Huh?
Make some device.
No, but why did you take up this education? You should just look around you and see so many devices and the knowledge just comes to you.
But if devices don't exist, unless somebody makes it here.
No. Why are you enrolled in formal PhD studies?
To make those devices.
No, but you don't need to go to the PhD. You just... All around are devices and
device.
Huh?
Device that can maybe atomize fluids, nanomake nanoparticles.
But why are you enrolled in a formal program of study?
Because I get access to the lab which can make these, which people can see.
Okay. So, all right, hold it right there. So, you take up Krishna's system for understanding reality, and you have formal access to the laboratory. And you have the guidance of professors who can point out to you, just like when you present your PhD, yes? Wait, listen. One thing at a time. Forget Krishna for a second. Let's not drag him in. Let's just deal with basic facts. Huh? No. You are saying, what was the first thing you said?
Krishna.
No. I appreciate that you seem to be attracted to Krishna, but the first thing you said was that, why? What is it? Who remembers what he said?
Krishna.
Wait.
Why does he need to read the Bhagavad Gita in the first instance? Why did Krishna need to read the Bhagavad Gita? Because he's a spirit soul, the message will come to him automatically.
So therefore I said, you said, why do you have to read Bhagavad Gita? The knowledge has come to you. I say, why? Wait a minute. What kind of student are you? Wait a second. Wait. Why are you enrolled in PhD when you can just get the knowledge everywhere? It'll just come to you. Just, you know, walk down Swanson Street and knowledge comes to you. There's so many devices in Swanson Street.
Yeah.
Now, you, how many years you have studied in school?
PhD.
Altogether, if your undergraduate, graduate studies.
18 years.
No. Undergraduate, you know.
4 plus 6.
6. Okay. 6 years, so you could become expert enough to understand your field. You studied under teachers. Yes?
Not right now.
But to get to PhD level, you studied under teachers. Okay? So similarly, what's wrong with taking instruction from Krishna, how to understand what he's saying?
Exactly, that's what I'm saying.
So that's what you should do. Huh?
Krishna is a supreme being, so I don't need the need to be here.
But if the Supreme Being says you need one, then you take it.
Yeah, the Supreme Being tells me directly.
No, in Bhagavad Gita, he says directly, you need help. You take it. Finished, okay? Thank you. Krishna says directly in Bhagavad Gita, Tadvidi pranipatena, pariprasnena sevaya. If you want to clearly understand what I'm saying, you must have a genuine teacher. All right? You take it like that. What happens when it's time for your PhD, what do you call it? Yes, but you know, when you... Right, three supervisors. You just don't tell your supervisors, I just tuned in and it all came to me. No, they make sure everything is authorized, right? And then what happens when it's time for your... You have to defend your thesis. Yes. And they make recommendations. Oh, no, you must change this. You must change that. Spend 2 more months doing this and that. Yes. Same thing in spiritual life. So we should be humble, not have this arrogance that won't even make it in the material world. Suppose you present yourself to, you know, your PhD supervisors. What do I need you guys for? I just tune in. They say, right, you can tune out. Get out of here. They're supervising you. They're checking your work, checking your progress. They may even give you a hard time sometime, you know. And then you have to defend your thesis. All this is going on. Why is it we want to take bhakti so cheaply? No, you must take it the authorized way. It is the greatest knowledge. It is the greatest mission in life. And therefore, everything is very serious. It's not casual, whimsical. Anything else? Yes.
I've been been told by someone that there is a huge part of the subconscious mind while you are approaching your goal. So whatever you want to achieve, you have to put it in the subconscious mind and then it starts running. So is it the way that whatever we want to do, first we have to put in, like, in, I don't know in which way, but put it in the subconscious mind and then it works on it, otherwise you miss it or you miss it by something else.
In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains, Manmana Bhavamad Bhakta. Always think of me, become my bhakta, my practitioner. By always thinking of Krishna, both your consciousness and the subconsciousness are infused, are saturated with Krishna thought. You don't have to get into all these intricacies of, should I program my subconsciousness while I'm sleeping? Should I, you know. If you are serving Krishna, connected to Krishna during the day, when you sleep at night, you'll naturally think about Krishna. So the bhakti process is a full program for becoming conscious of Krishna. That's why it's called Krishna consciousness. So your subconsciousness will be taken care of. You don't have to be in anxiety about that. You are studying psychology? What are you studying? Yes. This is the late one of the new boom fields, yes? Everyone's moved out of IT and now it's telecommunications, wireless, yes? And accounting also. Because there is a lack of accountants in Australia, right?
Yes.
How many accounting students we have here?
Mostly. Number one in Ammonia
list. So number one is accounting. Number two is what? Wireless communications, telecommunications?
Cookery.
Huh?
Cookery. Because that gets pretty hard.
Oh, cookery. We have many cooks here, huh? Well, why cookery course gives PR? They have a shortage of cooks?
Yeah.
Very big shortage.
Number one.
It can't
be outsourced.
No one cooks.
What's that?
It can't be outsourced. It can't be
So, when you study cookery, then what happens when you finish? Huh? You get a PR, and then you go to school and study accounting, right? Is that it? So, what is the goal for studying cookery? Is it actually serious that you'll go to a restaurant after that, or you're just getting the PR and then you find other avenues? Is that it? Huh?
That's a way for getting the visa.
How many years you have to study cookery?
2 years.
2 years. What's that?
MODL list.
That's a list by the immigration department.
Right.
They keep changing. Some courses they put in that list some years and they keep changing.
So you watch the list, right? Cookery is a little dangerous for the karma, though, isn't it? You have to cut up flesh and cook flesh, yes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Australia, all beef.
Very dangerous. Anyway, you keep coming here and associating with the bhakti process, and gradually you'll get a vision on what you should do about that. Huh? What's that? Yes. But while you're in the cookery class, you have to. I'm just saying at this point, I'm not going to get into it. I'm just saying it's dangerous for your karma. You may think, oh, I'm just studying, so what is the problem? It's part of the course. But nature's laws are acting. In the next life, the same thing has to happen to you. Someone will be studying and they'll be cutting you up. And they'll give the same excuse. It's just part of the course. I'm just studying to get my PR. All right. So, this evening when you come back, we'll be discussing the three phases of God realization. So you'll be able to say, what is God? We'll be talking about the preliminary understanding, which is Brahman, the intermediate understanding, which is called Paramatma, and then the ultimate, the complete understanding, which is called Bhagavan. All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.